Okay, I'm going to call to order this May 20th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. Welcome, everyone. We have a couple of public hearings and a few work sessions. And the order of the day will be to start with House Bill 3058A, and then we will do our work sessions, and then we'll do 3025, the Ban the Box Bill. For those of you who are here to see us vote on House Bill 2764, the attorney fees workers' comp bill, that bill is being amended, and so we will not be working that today. We'll carry it over till next Wednesday. And otherwise, I think we're ready to go. All right, so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3058. I'll ask Representative Comp to come up, please. And while she's doing that, Matt, can you tell us what this does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3058A permits retired Tier 1 and Tier 2 members of the public employee retirement system to work for school districts or education service districts as a teacher of career and technical education for an unlimited amount of hours without loss of retirement benefits. It defines teacher of career and technical education and sunsets June 30th, 2018, declaring emergency effective on passage. As it came through the House, it was determined that there is no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay, Representative, tell us about this good bill.
Thank you. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, it's my honor and pleasure to be here. I thank you and appreciate you holding the hearing here for House Bill 5038. For the record, I'm State Representative Betty Comp, and I represent House District 22, Woodburn, Jervis, and North Salem. What we've come into knowing, because I did give you a brief testimony, is we have been working with ETIC in our legislature, workforce development, number of things at higher ed, but we now, with the strategic initiatives through OEIB, we have passed legislation to say, well, we want to get, you know, sixth graders started in on knowing what this means. And the reality is many of these programs were shut down or closed over the past 15, 20 years because these are programs that cost, they just cost money. And when you're in a recession, you know, those doors closed. And so the other door that closed was the program at OSU to gain the certification to be these teach in these areas. And so what we now have is we've made the investments to start these programs up again, but we don't have a depth of highly trained teachers for this area. And so what this bill does is it will allow highly qualified retired teachers to return to the classroom with a little bit of a brush up or something and do it's a temporary slot that they'll fill, hopefully generate other interest in teachers that they might be teaching with to also get this certification to become a CTE STEM teacher. And there are already, I think, 13 exceptions to the PERS retirement fund where certain people can continue working, and this bill is only for, it will sunset in 3 years, and the intent is so that these teachers can return back for just a temporary time until we can get certification for other people that want to meet this high needs area that we're developing. And I see my wonderful staff. You have to always let people, I mean, we couldn't do this job without our staff. But here's the example. The West Metro area of Portland has only two CTE endorsed substitute teachers. There are virtually no substitute teachers in other areas in our state. So my friend here that's going to speak to this issue more is, and Senator Rosenbaum probably knows more about this, and I don't know how we can see if we can't look at the dates of implementation of how we're going to do this so that some of these teachers could be trained starting this summer. Because frequently in our process, after the governor signs the law, the department will spend maybe a month at looking at the allocations. But if we could get this training up and going this summer, it would really be a helpful solution to these schools. I'm here for until dawn. Mr. Domes testifies and for questions, and I just appreciate your time and consideration to make this temporary adjustment to the PERS retirement fund.
Thank you, Representative. And just before we go to Mr. Domes, so are you suggesting we put an emergency clause onto this bill?
I would leave that at your recommendations.
It has one?
It has one, and okay.
Okay, so we should be able to, assuming it passes, get things started this summer.
Chair Denbrough, when it passes, yeah.
Great, thank you.
Thank
Representative.
You.
Mr. Domes, welcome.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Comp, for your great words. Chairman Denbrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, and committee, thank you very much for holding this hearing. For the record, my name is Don Domes, and I'm a retired CTE teacher, a licensed tax consultant, and a small business consultant, and I'm a grandpa. And I'm here because I'm really concerned about Oregon. I'm in favor of House Bill 3058A, and I want to urge your support, the subsequent scheduling of a work session, and a due pass recommendation to the Senate. I really want to express my sincere appreciation to all of you for your support of CTE and STEM by not only this legislature, but also former legislative sessions. Due to the CTE revitalization grants, there is new life being breathed into CTE. I spent over 30 years of my life as a CTE teacher, and I can attest to the wonderful results from outstanding CTE programs, and at the heart of those programs, of course, is a CTE teacher. Many of us in CTE, especially in the industrial and engineering pathway, have become acutely aware of the lack of a pipeline of trained and prepared instructors. In 1991, OSU, due to complex financial times, canceled their technology and vocational teacher training program. That was almost 25 years ago, and we've never had a program of that caliber since. As you know, of course, on OLIS, the testimony that I and others provided in favor of House Bill 3058 is on OLIS. The bill passed 54-4 in the House. The bill allows, as Representative Comp explained, the bill allows for a retired CTE teacher to be brought back beyond the PERS 1039-hour limit. This provides an option for both retired CTE teachers who are available to come back, as well as administrators who want to have a highly qualified and experienced person in their classroom. The bill only empowers a small bridge to help us. The bill sunsets in 3 years. This bill is really a combination of a variety of bills. There's other bills looking at this issue of the CTE shortage. One of those is House Bill 2624, sponsored by Representative Reardon. I'm hoping that that is going to pass. This bill does not solve the problem. It's just a small bridge. There's another bill, House Bill 3166, that looks at a three-school district study to empower using non-certified industry professionals as CTE teachers in very small school districts. It limits it to school districts of under 3,500, and it's a study, a three-school district study. I totally support that also. Representative Barreto had spoken to that on the House floor during the vote for this bill. House Bill 3058 is not an answer to the shortage problem. It's just a bridge. and it's a group of this. It's part of a group of potential solutions. Bringing in people from industry is part of that. There's a lot of complexity to that because those who desire to leave into industry and go into teaching, there's a bunch of issues there. And part of that is that principals are often very hesitant in today's complex education environment with all the testing and everything to hire someone who does not already have significant educator training and experience. Retired CTEs, there's another issue, and that is that the dual credit, a lot of us want to see kids get at least 9 hours of credit. Those credits, if there's dual credit available, are attached to the instructor because the instructor has to qualify through the college. So even though you bring in a new person, they may not be able to qualify as a college instructor, and then your dual credit would go away. And our experienced people oftentimes have negotiated that myriad of process to be college certified for offering high school credit. As a CTE teacher, I've worked with thousands of students. As a licensed tax professional over the last 25 plus years, I can't tell you how often I've heard about the need to raise personal income by folks as we're preparing those returns. It's imperative for our Oregon workforce that we help students discover their pathway, and for many students, that CTE teacher is a big key to doing that. Thank you so much for allowing us to speak to you, and we'd be happy to entertain any questions or comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Domes. Thanks for coming, and thanks for your work in CTE in general. This committee is very supportive of career technical education. Just last week or 2 weeks ago, we passed a similar bill in the post-secondary setting having to do with nursing instructors and DPSST instructors, and this is very much in line with that. Colleagues, any questions about this? Yes, Senator Knoop.
Thank you, Chair Denbro. Do either of you have a good handle on the acute nature of the shortage as it relates to CTE instructors? I mean, is there any study that's been done to show that we're just lacking in a woeful way on it?
The main thing that I'm aware of is, like at Aloha High School last year, we had a half-time woods job that went unfilled the entire year. When I pulled the sublist from the Washington County, basically the West Metro area, we have just a few people on the sublist, but there's only two people for industrial and engineering pathway, and neither one of those are subbing. So I also was aware of some job applications and where we would send out job post things on EdZap, et cetera, and we get very few applicants, and very few of those are actually qualified, have experience, or would be the people that could keep a complex and exciting program going. Back in about 11, we had a huge downturn, as everyone knows, and some of you may have read in the Oregonian, in my school, we were the fourth largest district in the state, we were going to cancel the auto program down to half-time. Now, a half-time auto teacher at teacher rate would make about the same as the lube tech in a dealership. And I was that crazy person that said to the district, I will fundraise the other half. Because we only have, you know, four high schools, we're the largest, fourth largest district in the state. I knew if we lost that auto program, there's only like 43 auto programs in the state. The teacher was what I considered one of the top five in the state. It takes 5 to 10 years to rebuild a program. We're just not being able to find people. At the same time that we were trying to find a CTE teacher in one district, we had four applicants. Not all of those I felt were really qualified. There was like 155 applicants for four vice principal positions. So this is the magnitude of the, and part of it is I had a gentleman that would have been excellent from industry to bring in last year. He spent 3 days in the classroom with me. At the end of the 3 days, I was very excited about him, and I felt I had to be honest and take him to the salary schedule. Showed him the salary schedule, and I said, you'll start at 42. And he said, well, gosh, I'm making 75 in industry right now. And I lost him. So there's a combination of things here that are impacting this.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and I think as acute as the problem is, it's only going to grow more acute. with the aging teaching workforce, and also we hope some really substantial reinvestment in CTE in this session. We're going to need teachers to fill those slots. Any other questions? Okay, thank you both very much. We'll be scheduling a work session for this bill soon.
Thank you very much.
Okay, with that, I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3058. And colleagues, we have a few work sessions that I want to do now, starting with House Bill 2007. Thank you. Matt, can you remind us what this is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2007A makes a disciplinary action against an employee who inquires about or discloses wage information an unlawful employment practice and provides employees with a private right of action and creates an exception. There was no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Thank you. Senator, would you make a motion, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2007A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved House Bill 2007A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of this measure?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
I do have some concerns. I support the underlying intent of this bill. I just really do have some concerns where regular conversations, especially between management and an employee, could be added to the list of things yet to be causing problems, I guess, in the workplace.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, Carrie, could you please call the roll?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Thatcher?
No.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Senator Rosenbaum, would you like to carry it?
Be happy to.
Okay. Okay, let's close the work session on House Bill 2007A. And we will open a work session on House Bill 2600.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2600 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher has moved House Bill 2600 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Colleagues, this is the bill having to do with health care coverage while someone is on Oregon Family Leave Act. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Knopf.
Do we have a good handle on the cost to business of this particular measure?
You know, I think it's speculative. There was, as I recall, we had discussion during the hearing that in many cases the replacement workers who would come in during the OFLA leave would probably not qualify for health insurance. So most employers likely won't be paying twice for this, which I think was the concern, in which case it should be no additional cost to the employer. Any further discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair.
I had mentioned to you on the floor that I don't believe most employers would do this anyway, in which case I'm sure you'd say, well, then it shouldn't matter. We'll just pass it anyway. But sometimes there will be situations that arise where maybe they would not be able to do it, especially if it's for a long period of time, which I think will be rare circumstances. But there are circumstances where I think an employer would like to, you know, get out from that obligation, not because they want to. And I, like I said, don't believe most are doing that. I just really disagree with the mandate, I guess. I think it's sort of it's not really a problem right now. And I understand you're just trying to ensure that it doesn't become one, but it so far hasn't become a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, Senator.
I'll be a yes out of committee today. I would like to get more information, though, if anybody has any, on any potential cost to business, so we can get a better handle on that, because obviously the main concern is that we want people to have health insurance, but we also want them to have a job too. So we want to make sure that this doesn't create a situation where we're being counterproductive.
Thank you. Okay, Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Knoth?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair Deborah?
Aye. Motion carries. I will carry it. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2600. And let's open a work session on House Bill 3516.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash A2 amendment stated May 5th, 2015 to House Bill 3516A.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher has moved to adopt the Dash A2 amendments dated May 5th, 2015. Matt, could you tell us what these do and just remind us of what this bill is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3516A requires schools obtaining approval from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, the HEC, to offer academic degrees to obtain a bond or letter of credit annually demonstrating that the school is financially sound and capable of fulfilling commitments to students. The measure establishes requirements for bonds and letters of credit and specifies the calculation formula for the amount of bond or letter of credit necessary. It also grants students the right to bring a claim against the school, bond, or letter of credit if the student suffers monetary loss due to the school's failure to provide educational services, and establishes process for commission to place the school or program on probation or to revoke approval for the school to offer academic degrees. There was the A2 amendments that are now being moved would add an emergency clause to this measure. And the fiscal impact, there is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Thank you, Matt. And I think the need for the emergency clause is a follow-up on our discussion the other day that there, this is a very volatile industry right now, and we have schools that are, you know, in danger of needing action. And so there's a desire to get working on this right away. Any further discussion of this amendment to add an emergency clause? Is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Vice Chair.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3516A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved House Bill 3516A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Is there any objection to this motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. I'll carry this one. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3516A. And again, colleagues, we're carrying over House Bill 3025.
That's the bin box. We're going to get there.
Sorry. We're not carrying that over.
Sure?
I will say once again that I am an English teacher, not a math teacher. I'm not good with the numbers. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2471A. And before the motion, Matt, remind us, this is one of those mortuary
It bills. Is, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2471A changes the qualifications to practice as a funeral service practitioner or embalmer, including qualifications related to reciprocity and training, and replaces references to apprentice with trainee, declares an emergency effective on passage. The Dash A4 amendments in front of you do make a couple of technical changes by moving the some of the parts of the bill into a different statute, but doesn't change really much in the meat of the bill. There is no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you. Vice Chair?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the A4 amendment stated May 20th, 2015 to House Bill 2471A.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher has moved to adopt the Dash A4 amendments dated May 20th, 2015. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none. So ordered. Vice Chair?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2471A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved House Bill 2471A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I do have a couple questions still that I need to get clarified. So I'm going to be no for now, but I might change that because I just wondered if this is making it easier, actually easier for people to practice. I think it is making it qualifications based and letting people go through more quickly. I just wanted to check on a couple things.
Okay,
so
that's fine.
That's where I'm at.
And again, I think the goal is to not tie it to seat time, you know, as it has been, but rather proficiencies, which could create more flexibility in people entering the field.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelson?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair Dembrough?
Aye. The motion passes. I think I'm going to ask our in-house purveyor of doom and gloom to carry this bill. That is Senator Gelser. Thank you. With that, I will close our work session on House Bill 2471 and open our final work session, that on House Bill 2472A. And this is another happy bill. Matt, can you remind us what this one does?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2472A allows the Mortuary and Cemetery Board to establish a self-inspection program to supplement biennial inspections. It also allows the board to set criteria through rule by which exempt operating cemeteries will not be subject to biennial inspections, and repeal statutes on magistrate-issued warrants for inspection of facilities under board jurisdiction. The Dash A2 amendments that you have today make a change in the way that the board can employ persons to perform self-inspection programs.
Okay, Mr. Chair, move to adopt the A2 amendment, dated May 20th, 2015.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved to adopt the A2 amendments, dated May 20th, 2015. Any discussion of the amendments? Any objection to the amendments? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2472A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved House Bill 2472A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I'm going to be voting yes.
Great.
Just thought I'd throw that out.
Okay. Any further declarations or questions? No. Seeing none, is there any objection to our passing this bill? Seeing none, so ordered. And again, I will ask the good senator from whatever you're called, the heart of Oregon.
The heart of the valley,
to carry this bill. And with that, I will close our work session on House Bill 2472A. And now I will open our public hearing on House Bill 3025A. I'll ask Representative Peluso to come up, please. And while she's doing so, Matt, if you could read the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3025A. Establishes an unlawful employment practice for employers in the following cases: the use of a job application form that inquires about an applicant's conviction history, inquiring about or considering an applicant's conviction history prior to an interview, or inquiring about or considering an applicant's conviction history prior to making a conditional offer of employment when no interview is conducted. The measure creates a right of civil action for a violation. As this came through the House, the fiscal office did issue a fiscal impact, and there is no revenue impact.
Okay. Representative Peluso, welcome.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair Dembrough and members of the Senate Workforce Committee. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, and I am the representative from House District 50, which is Gresham and a small portion of Southeast Portland. I am here to speak in support of House Bill 3025. As many of you may know, I worked in law enforcement for 30 years with the Gresham Police Department. I started in 1979 and was promoted through every rank, spending my last 6 years as Gresham's police chief. I always balanced my law enforcement career by being heavily involved in nonprofit work centered on reducing homelessness and poverty. With my experience, I've seen firsthand the devastation that recidivism has on individuals, families, and communities. It is not pretty. While many think of law enforcement as a crime response or serving justice, an often overlooked goal is to prevent future crime. If an individual serves their time and takes steps to turn their life around, we need to ensure that the system is set up to support these positive steps away from criminal behavior. Far too many, including the approximately 32,000 people currently under the Department of Corrections control, have the ability to even interview for a job, as they are inhibited by that little box on job applications. When people with prior convictions and arrests are continually denied the opportunity to even interview for employment, let alone be offered a job, we are instead pushing them back towards their criminal past. The single most effective deterrent against reoffending is employment. Chair Demereaux and members of the committee, I urge you all to support House Bill 3025. This bill is the best choice to make sure all of our constituents have a fair chance at being able to make it to an interview and, if successful, a job and a real shot at a stable future. House Bill 3025 ensures that our justice system can keep its promise of a second chance for those who have served their time. Thank you for your time on this important issue.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions for the representative? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. I am not going to close this hearing because we have a lot of people who are going to speak on it. And so if you have questions, you're going to have a lot of opportunity to ask them. So our first panel is Alberta McCoy, Teresa Sweeney, and Salome Chimuku, please. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here. You can go in any order that you'd like, but just start off by identifying your, saying your name aloud.
Okay. My name is Alberta McCoy.
Welcome. And go ahead.
Chair Demereaux and members of the committee, I work at Mercy Corps Northwest Reentry Transition Center, and I'm one of the navigators there, and I have an opportunity to serve hundreds of people in a year, helping them to get on their road to recovery and to be a good, upstanding citizen, and to actually help them find services to be able to lift themselves out of criminal activity and get themselves on the road to become a taxpaying citizen. I identify with them because I used to be in their shoes, and I've had a lot of opportunities to actually be able to do a reentry and be able to be an upstanding citizen. And it's just a sad occasion that you never have been forgiven. I go through that myself, you know, when I previously applied for jobs and that opportunity is not there, and I got to answer that question and never get a call back or get the job, and then after they do the background check, they say, you know, you're not hired. We decided we wasn't going to hire you. So I know how that feels, and it's just a constant battle, and it's a hard place to be without your help on House Bill 3025. And I really would like for you to look at that and really have an understanding of what we go through with legal history and how demeaning it is, and you don't even feel like you're an American citizen, and you feel thrown away. And today I just feel empowered by having a job and be able to pay taxes and be able to take care of myself and be able to take care of my family and live a good life. But the question just goes on and on and on, and you just never are able to live it down. I think once you do your time and you're on the right road, that at some point somebody ought to welcome you back. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
Welcome.
I guess I'm next. Chair Demereaux and committee, thank you for taking the time to listen to me today. My name is Teresa Sweeney. I am a native of Portland. I've lived there most of my life, raised three children there, been very involved in the community, worked volunteering at all the way from my children's school to food banks to big events like Hands Across the Bridge. Between 2001 and 2003, I was breaking the law, earned four felony convictions, and I was incarcerated in the prison in Utah until 2004. 2004, I was released. Within a 15-month period, I was released from parole early, was working a minimum wage job, and had returned and earned my bachelor degree in criminology and criminal justice. I kind of thought that would be my road back to being able to get gainful employment and take care of my family. I came up with some challenges, couldn't really find work that was in my field of study, and definitely was pretty low wage. So I decided to return to school. I thought maybe if I got my master's, gave a few more years, the distance between me and my criminal behavior showed my responsibility, that would open more doors for me. Again, in 2010, I earned my master's. Again, that did not happen. I still wasn't working in my field, and I also wasn't working enough where I could take care of my family without some help. And in 2013, I even went into the state of Utah, and I received a full and unconditional pardon for the crimes committed there. Again, I thought the doors would open and my opportunities would open. Still, that hasn't happened. I've been working for the past 4 years for VOA, working at the Women's Residential Center first, but it was still below my skill set. And I'm now working with people that go through the drug courts. I'm the alumni court coordinator for all the drug courts in Multnomah County. And although I enjoy my job, I just got it a few months ago, it still is not allowing me to do all the things that I feel I can do. I'm very committed to reentry, people coming back into the community. I'd like to be able to share my strength and encouragement with them, and so far I've been denied that. So what I am asking today is that you support House Bill 3025 so we can do like Alvaro was talking about. Once your debt to society has been paid, you know, it's kind of what we say, when does it end? When I go to check that little box on that application, there's been jobs that I've just gone against, because it kind of brings up that whole thing, brings up that whole shame and all that stuff associated with it. And even though I feel I've worked very hard and done very well, it still really affects me. So I would ask for your support.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sweeney. Salome, welcome.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Salome Chimuku. I'm the public policy director at the Center for Intercultural Organizing, and I'm here today to ask your support of House Bill 3025. CIO is very committed to helping our members achieve through leadership development as well as other structures, and we're here today to urge your support because our members, in terms of the immigrant refugee people in Oregon, suffer very unique particular when it comes to this issue, predominantly when folks too often are in our communities end up in these situations. It is through being told that if they simply comply, things will go easier for them in terms of avoiding deportation and avoiding just basically impediments on their life. Unfortunately, that is not the case. And I just wanted to share with you a quick highlight of one of our members named Antonio, who very similar to many of our other members, pled guilty to a crime he didn't commit because he was in fear that if he had stayed in the courts longer, that he would face deportation charges. And so he pled guilty to a charge related to marijuana. And as soon as the court proceeding was over, he was picked up and taken to the Tacoma facility, where he spent over a year missing various things in his life, such as the birth of his child, his own graduation ceremony, and among other things. Once he was told that he was going to now have to face deportation in that whole case proceeding, his attorney told him that the best thing he could do for himself is, one, get a job, and two, provide support for his U.S.-born citizen son. And so with that, he went, tried to find work, couldn't find work. It became a problem now, because now the courts were saying he was an individual who wasn't bringing anything to the table. He had no work, he wasn't paying his child support, he was barely paying his attorney fees, and thusly was painted as a picture of someone who just wasn't being a benefit to society, and thusly shouldn't be allowed to stay in the United States. This is not unique to his situation. Many of our members are told that if you have gainful employment or stable employment, you're more likely to get renewed status under immigrant or refugee status, as well as if you have a U.S.-born child. And so he went through paid a lot of money to go through the expungement process, went through a pardon process and still couldn't find employment. And it led to the point where he decided that he was just going to open his own business since no one was going to hire him. Antonio was very qualified, had multiple degrees from computer science all the way to licensing as a general contractor, and now owns his own business in the Portland metro area, building homes from the ground up. And so essentially, we at CIO feel that folks shouldn't have to pay thousands of dollars to get a fair shot. They should be able to apply for employment and at least given the opportunity to explain what their conviction was and, you know, put that against who they are today and what they have done to change their life. And so we urge your support on House Bill 3025. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Salome. Let me start with the first question, and for Ms. McCoy and Ms. Sweeney again, thank you very much for coming. The way that the bill is currently written, the subject of a person's background couldn't come up until there's a face-to-face interview that happens. What do you think of the timing of that? Does that How is that better from your perspective than the existing system of, you know, having that box checked up front?
Chair Denver and members of the community, I think it's very helpful because if it's not like that and you just go in there and you fill out an application just like everybody else and that's on the question is on there, then most of the time it's going in the garbage. But at least if you're in front of the employer, you can have a chance to speak for yourself and explain, yes, that does happen. You know, yes, there was some things I did in my life, but this is how I corrected them. This is what I've been doing for the last 20 years. This is the community people that I've been involved with. This is what I've been doing to give back, and this is what I'm doing today. That's a lot easier than just reading about what that person done and looking at that person that this is a horrible person. I don't want this person working anywhere in my business. So that's why I think it's good that you're able to sit in front of the employer and be able to talk to that person, and that person is looking you straight in the eye and be able to say, here I am today, and this is what I've done.
Thank you. Do you have anything?
Yeah, and I agree with that. And also, for me, too, it's the barrier and going against it over and over and over again. Because, you know, if you're applying for a job, you have to apply for, you know, say hundreds or whatever you're going in. And if you're marking that box every time, to me, it kind of eats away at you every time to do that. And I'm afraid of it leading to discouragement because I look at myself. I have a fairly high skill set, education, all this stuff. And if it's been this hard for me, I can't imagine how hard it's been for other people. And sometimes people, they can come overcome four barriers, but that fifth one, say, is just too much. And so just making it where people, where you feel and feel connected so you're not having to defend yourself every time. And it's just, yeah. And also sometimes apply for jobs, because sometimes when I would see that box, I wouldn't even apply for the job because I just, you know, if you're applying for so many, so I think it would really make people feel more connected, too.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other questions? Vice Chair Thatcher.
We talked a little bit in my office, Salome, about the results. It's kind of a fairly new, I guess, legislation that's been going around the states. I know Hawaii was first, and I'm wondering how effective they are at reducing recidivism and helping people get back on their feet.
Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, thank you for that question. There's someone who's going to be testifying on those results and those numbers that can answer that question for you. I just don't want to eat into their testimony.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions for this panel? Okay. Again, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, if we could have Jason Myers, Jill Hymanson, and Matt Newell Ching, please.
My name is Jill Hymanson. Hi, Senator Denbrough and members of the committee. I am here today to support this Ban the Box legislation. A little background on myself. Once I was divorced, I decided to go back to school and study economics and get my degree. But at the same time, my ex, who's a dentist, decided he was going to stop working at his practice and let the practice go under. So I went through a foreclosure, a bankruptcy, and which I was able to somehow manage. Although once he started to go after my kids, that's when things got real. And I made a mistake, and I landed myself 2 misdemeanor assault 4 charges, which landed me 3 years of probation, community service, anger management, drug and alcohol, the whole plethora of taxpayer-funded rehabilitative services, which I completed. I'm off probation and everything now today. But the problem is that I have this on my record now. And so when I go to apply for jobs, I have to check the box. And what happens is I like the other people said, I'm confident that my cover letter and resume goes directly in the trash. So in retrospect, I feel like it would have been better once I got the charges under the current system is if I would have just dropped out of college. Because now I have $70,000 in student loans that I can't get a job. I've been unemployed for a year. I've been applying for jobs, and it's radio silence. And so my hope is that if this by chance were to pass, I would have a hope to, get my life back on track in a career, and then I would be able to pay everybody back, and everybody would be happy. A few points I wanted to make. The first one is that the fact that all this money was spent on the rehabilitative services, it basically nullifies it if I'm unable to participate in the labor market because employers are freely allowed to discriminate against me. The next thing was that you had asked about the timing as far as the way they have talked about it in the city of Portland is to wait until the disclosure happens after an offer has already been extended. And in my opinion, that would be better because there's still, even if you were able to get the interview, if you have to disclose it at that point, you're still going to go. If they've already if the offer is extended and they determine that you are the one they want for the job, that would be the time, in my opinion, to disclose it. And the other thing the city of Portland was talking about doing is making an administrative process. So if, say, I was able to get a job in finance and they, extended the offer but then found out about my assault charges and decided that, we can't have somebody in here who might just go around hitting people, which I think I would not do. But so there would be an administrative process to, maybe work through it and see if, this is something that can work together or not. Finally, the last thing I'd like to mention is that even the Koch brothers support Ban the Box legislation. They recently banned the box throughout their whole entire organization. So this is something that hopefully conservatives and the Democrats and Republicans can both get behind. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Jill.
Good afternoon, Chair Dambro, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. For the record, Matt Newell Ching, Public Affairs Director for Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon. Partners for Hunger-Free Oregon supports HB 3025 to ban the box. When Oregon's returning citizens have opportunities to earn a living, provide for their families, and make the most of a second chance, every community in Oregon is better off. And for us, this bill boils down to a pretty simple choice. When Oregonians who have paid their debt to society return to our communities, should they have a fair chance at employment opportunities that create family stability and safe neighborhoods? Or should returning citizens continue to face difficult barriers putting their lives back together, leading to what is in many cases tantamount to a life sentence of poverty? And in many cases, a return to prison. So we believe the choice is clear. Removing barriers to employment makes sense for Oregon's returning citizens, for our communities. The box on employment applications is a barrier to employment. Chair Dembrough, you had asked earlier about what difference it makes in terms of the point in the process. Research shows that criminal records reduces the likelihood of a job callback on applications by 50%. So it's very, very significant. And the bottom line is that it's in everyone's best interest when all Oregonians have a fair chance to work through viable pathways out of poverty into the middle class. So we urge your support on the Ban the Box bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matt. Mr. Myers.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm Marion County Sheriff. I'm also here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Chiefs Association. And our request is for adoption of either the -5 or -13 amendment, which would create an exemption for law enforcement around Ban the Box. As you can probably understand, law enforcement backgrounds are very rigorous and lengthy, and there's a lot of steps involved. And just to give you an idea, in my organization, for every one certified position I fill, I have about 100 applicants that go through a process. And there are a number of steps that occur prior to an interview. And there are certain provisions that prohibit individuals with criminal records from either being certified as a police officer or a probation officer or a corrections officer in the state of Oregon, as well as accessing sensitive databases at a state level and federal level. So we believe that having this exemption for law enforcement would be helpful. It would be time-saving. It would save money for local law enforcement agencies as well as the individuals applying, because they likely wouldn't be eligible for certification or to work in this field. So we would ask that you take a look at that and look at adopting those amendments.
Thank you very much, Ms. Myers, and thank you for coming to speak to us. I will say there was reference to the two amendments. We'll be considering two amendments. One is the very limited one dealing with law enforcement. There is a larger one that includes that, but I'll just read you the relevant section, which says that the the requirement to not be able to bring this issue up until the interview does not apply if federal, state, or local law requires the consideration of an applicant's criminal history. B, to an employer that is a law enforcement agency. C, to an employer in the criminal justice system. Or D, to an employer seeking a non-employee volunteer. So those, and so we may well wind up with a more expansive amendment, but that would include addressing your concern.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, colleagues, any questions of this panel? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, let's have Betsy Earls, Sean Miller, and Lana Butterfield. Come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association, the Portland Business Alliance. We're here in opposition to 3025, but we're here also here to be constructive. I think this is a bill that, if amended, we'd like to support the bill, Mr. Chairman. There's just a few things that we would like to offer up as amendments. I think the exemptions that you mentioned on some state and federal requirements, just so we're not stringing someone along up until the point where they're ineligible to actually get the job, I think is important to address those concerns, as you heard from the public safety folks. And so, that's the one thing that we would like to see in the bill. The second is to remove the private right of action. I think we believe this should be an administrative remedy. And so I think just removing that private right of action is another asset that we would like to see. And then third, the preemption for local municipalities. We know that other cities are looking at this, and we would like to avoid a patchwork approach on employment issues and, again, hiring practices. And so, this bill offers up a statewide solution that we think strikes that right balance between promoting the goal of increasing opportunity for employment and ensuring a safe work environment for the employees and their customers. And so, those are the three things that we would like to see in the bill, Mr. Chairman. And again, we'd like to work with you and the committee on getting there, because it's something I think would be good for the employees as well as our companies. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. And I'm appearing before you in opposition to the current version of House Bill 3025. But like Sean, Wanted to talk to you a little bit about the way the bill is shaping up, and I think we could probably get to a position where we'd be supporting it. On the House side, there was a great deal of work done, and we kind of came out with the A engrossed version, which was, I believe, a step in the right direction, but unfortunately ended up leaving a few things out. And I know that you have some amendments before you also, most particularly the Dash 5s probably, that offer some of the exemptions that we would like to see that are very helpful. I think we would make the same asks that Mr. Miller has made to you, primarily remove the private right of action in the bill and make this an administrative, a boldly enforced issue instead of something that's in the discrimination statutes. We would also like to preempt local mandates that are more restrictive than the law that you are considering. And again, as you heard from the previous witnesses, we do have some members that are already banning the box on their applications. Most of the members that are doing that are not those that have employees who are in sensitive work situations, particularly those that their job would require the issue of a, I think it's called a standard fidelity bond, which is typically something that people have to have when they enter a person's, when their job requires them to enter a person's house to paint, you know, to be the locksmith or to help with, you know, house cleaning or any of those big services that do that on a regular basis. I think you've covered some of the concerns that we had by exempting employers from the requirement if the criminal check is required by state and federal law, but we would ask you to take a look at those other employers too, because those employees will have to have a criminal history check in order to qualify for the bond before they would be able to take that job. So again, I think the bill is getting, I think it's definitely getting there. It's obviously gone through a lot of iterations. We're working on another set of amendments that we would appreciate your consideration on, and we look forward to continuing to work with you.
Okay, great, thank you. Lana, hello.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here on behalf of two clients, the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho, and American Family Insurance Company. We, too, have sympathy with the folks who are bringing this bill. However, insurance agents in particular have to submit consideration of their criminal history to the insurance division before they will be granted a license to sell insurance, and if they have a fraud conviction, they probably are not able to receive a license. And American Family Insurance Company is constrained by the federal law called the Violent Crime Control Act, and I have to confess I'm not exactly sure what that says, but it does, I know that it does control who they can hire. It would just make sense to exempt also in the Dash 5s, put some little sentence after who that exemption could apply to include people who by law are not able to hire people with certain types of convictions. So that is our ask also. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Lana. I do think that Dash 5s get there, but you might, and they're posted on OLIS now, you might share them with your principals and see if that addresses their concern. Questions, colleagues? Okay, I guess we're going to have
Mr.
to work
Chair.
With you. okay, thank you very much. We now have our final panel. One of whom will be on the phone, and the other two who are here, Tom Chamberlain, please, and Midge Purcell. And we have Michelle Rodriguez. And I think Ms. Rodriguez will give us that national perspective. So we'll start with her.
Yeah. Hello, this is Michelle Rodriguez.
Hello, Ms. Rodriguez. This is Michael Dembro. I chair the Oregon Senate Workforce Committee, and we're very pleased to have you with us for this hearing. And we have a panel. You'll be with Tom Chamberlain from the AFL-CIO and Mitch Purcell from the Urban League. But why don't you kick it off. Tell us who you are and what you do.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate you, Chair Dembro, and the committee members for having me patched in by phone. My name is Michelle Natividad Rodriguez, and I'm a senior staff attorney with the National Employment Law Project, and I am honored to testify in support of this bill. NELP, if you don't know us, we advocate for workers' rights. We have been recognized as a national leader in this movement for fair chance hiring reform, which does include ban the box. Now, one of the reasons for that is because this is such a serious issue that affects all of our workers, because we estimate that there are about 70 million people with arrest and conviction records across the United States. What that means is that's about 1 in 3 adults in the U.S. I mean, that number you all should really find staggering. I know I do. And with this bill, what the state has the opportunity to do is really join that bipartisan effort, being smart on crime and reducing barriers to employment for the tens of thousands of qualified workers. One of the things that I think is really important to point out is that this has been a tried and tested policy, and we've done a deep dive into a lot of these policies as well. I've worked with dozens of jurisdictions across the country, and I've really seen how this policy has been effective in increasing employment opportunities. So this, as it was pointed out actually by Senator Thatcher, I believe, this did start out with Hawaii in 1998, so that's quite a while ago. It's now 17 years since that policy was first adopted, and now we have a total of 17 states and over 100 local jurisdictions that have embraced this policy. So on that question of effectiveness, I think this is a very important one. There are numerous jurisdictions like Hawaii that have had this in place for many years. And there was a study that came out of Hawaii just last year that just showed that there was a correlation between reducing recidivism in one of their counties and the ban the box policy. So that's some preliminary research. And as well, there are other jurisdictions that have collected some data. Minneapolis, Durham, Atlanta, they all showed an increase in hiring for people with records as well. And I don't know of any policy that's been rescinded here. We're talking about policies that have been in place for years, and in fact, we've only heard positive feedback. We also know that the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, they officially recommended this as a best practice. Now, the reason for that is because it would support compliance with federal anti-discrimination law with Title VII. I also want to point out that there has been some misinformation, I think a misunderstanding about sensitive positions and exempting those. What's important to remember here is this does not prevent a background check. You can still do a background check, and for that reason, even the Federal Office of Personnel Management, which is responsible for positions of the highest national security, recommends delaying any conviction history inquiry until after the conditional offer, which is even further than what this bill does. And as again, I'm talking about really the most highly sensitive job positions. Part of the reason for that is because it just makes sense resource-wise. You want to delay that conviction history inquiry until the conditional offer so you can minimize the amount of people you are doing a background check on. So also, I just want to point out as well that Oregon would be in good company. There are several states that have included private employers too. Hawaii was the one that I mentioned. There's also Illinois, there's Massachusetts, there's Minnesota, New Jersey, Rhode Island. In addition to these 6 states, there's a dozen localities now that have adopted these policies applying to private employers. So you have our big number of 17 states and over 100 cities and counties that have the wide range, and then some more specifically on private employers. And I'll point out, just when Governor Chris Christie, just last year when he signed legislation for private employers, he really recognized that this, and I quote, was going to make a huge difference for folks who have paid their debts to society. I just bring that up because, again, it's just to show that there's real bipartisan support for this. And as one individual mentioned earlier, we even have Koch Industries on board. We have Governor Nathan Deal saying out of Georgia and being a leader in the Deep South that this would enhance Georgia's reputation as the number one place to do business by increasing qualified applicant pools. I think that's really profound to hear that from a leader in the Deep South, and again, to just point out that this is a bipartisan effort. So we do hope that, and I do want to support and encourage the passage of this legislation, and for Oregon to really join the call for a fair chance for all. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Can you stay on the line for a bit?
I will, yes.
Okay, thank you. Then let's go to Tom, if you want to, or Mitch, whichever.
Tom?
Thank you. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name's Tom Chamberlain, and I'm the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill today. You know, our focus as a federation of labor in this state and nationally is on making the lives of working people, union and non, better. And mass incarceration is a problem in this country. It's a problem that hits hardest on communities of color, and especially the African-American community. A New York Times poll, actually, for those unemployed men between the ages of 25 and 54 are actually higher than the one-third that the previous person who gave testimony reported on. This is our workforce, and this is the reality of our economy that we live with every day. As you've heard from earlier panels, right now, we know that workers with previous records are not being hired, not because they're not trying, but because too often employers are not allowing them to even receive interviews. Last summer, we've been working on this for quite some time. Last summer, we had a town hall meeting, and I was at a breakout table with a woman in her 60s who was a grandmother who 15 years ago had been in prison. And she asked me the question, when do I stop being punished? I'm trying my best and I'm not getting ahead. We have a choice in this state right now. We can choose to agree that after a person does their time in a correction institution, that their time is done. Or we can say once a person has served their time, they need to continue to face barriers to finding jobs, often the most integral part of their success and identity. Too often, these barriers last a lifetime. On behalf of the 300,000 working men and women of the Oregon AFL-CIO, we urge your support for a bill that really does something. I've been in this building a long time, and once in a while, a bill gets watered down so much it really isn't good policy. I urge you to support a strong bill and to support 3025.
Thank you very much, Tom. Mitch, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Chair Dembrough and members of the Workforce Committee, my name is Mitch Purcell, and I'm Director of Advocacy and Public Policy for the Urban League of Portland. One of the benefits of speaking at the end is that many of your points have already been making, but my job this afternoon was to explain the provisions in the bill and why we believe that it will reduce barriers to employment for people who are just trying to reenter the workforce, just trying to earn a living, and make a positive contribution to their families and communities. In its current iteration, HB 3025 just removes the box from the application form that asks if an applicant has had a previous arrest or conviction record and delays those questions until later in the hiring process at interview stage. That's the current iteration. Asking questions about criminal history on the application, people have testified, often screens out candidates who may be best qualified for the job. The bill allows applicants to get their foot in the door, to present themselves and their qualifications as a whole package. In the state of Oregon, nearly 5,000 people are released from prison every year. 5,000. And there are currently 32,000 people either in prison or under custodial care of the criminal justice system. All the research shows that a job is the best way to reduce the revolving door of recidivism. By reducing barriers to earning a living and ensuring people who have served their time get a chance to earn a paycheck reduces the likelihood that they will reoffend. So it makes sense, I think, as a state to do everything that we can to lower the percentage of returning citizens from going back into the criminal justice system, which just increases the cost burden to the state. Instead, we should be giving people the opportunity to contribute to the economy and, as I said before, contribute to their community. The inability to find a job not only affects the individual, but also decreases the overall family income by 15%. We know that 83% of men who are released from prison need financial help from their family. And these are the families that often have the least ability to provide that help. So it creates a financial hardship for more than 30% of those families. And these are families for which income security and poverty has an effect on educational outcomes for their kids and often leads to poor health outcomes and poor mental health outcomes. So back to the content of the bill. As I think we've established, the bill in no way prevents employers from inquiring about criminal convictions during the course of an interview or asking for a criminal background check. This bill will not override any law that bars employment in certain occupations, nor for individuals convicted of specific crimes. With the suggested amendments, which we support, it will be clear that the legislation will not include law enforcement, it won't include people working with vulnerable populations, or I believe we also include volunteers. It will not include volunteers. So when a person has done their time and they've paid their debt to society, all they ask is for a fair chance to convince employers why they are qualified for the job, explain what they can bring to an employer's business, and not face discrimination because of something that represented the worst moment of their lives. So we urge support of HB 3025A and I'm available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mitch. Vice Chair Thatcher, did you have, was your question answered by Ms. Rodriguez?
Kind of. Okay. My more specific question wasn't related to hiring of people. Yes, of course it would increase, but I'm wondering its direct effects on recidivism. It sounds like those are kind of preliminary, so it doesn't sound like those records or the studies, maybe they don't exist yet, or they're just very preliminary. Is that my understanding, as far as its effect on recidivism, this policy's effect on recidivism?
Right. Ms. Rodriguez, can you address that?
Sure. The one study that I know came out last year out of Hawaii, and it specifically was looking at the effect of recidivism after a ban-the-box policy, and it showed some correlation between the reduction of recidivism and the ban-the-box policy. That's the one study that I know of at this point, specifically about Ban the Box. As you can imagine, whenever you're looking at one specific policy and the myriad of different factors that affect public safety, it is challenging. We do know, as Midge pointed out and several other individuals, that employment is one of the most significant factors in reducing recidivism. And so there, that's where a lot of the link is made.
Thank you.
I can buy that.
Yeah. Other questions, colleagues? Yes, Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the Dash 5 amendment, and you mentioned that it wouldn't cover positions caring for vulnerable people. I'm having trouble finding that in the amendment.
I think that relates to the statute, the provisions that are already in statute that, you know, covers people working with vulnerable populations, children, the elderly, the disabled, other vulnerable populations, which is usually currently in state or federal statute.
Great. Thank you very much.
Great. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
One of the other concerns that gets brought up sometimes by employers is a concern about a liability for negligent hiring specifically. And I think I was kind of cruising here. It looks like Kansas is the only state that explicitly limits liability for employers who apply the statute standard of review for criminal records. I don't even know what I just said there, but anyway, that's what I'm just reading online here. Would the people who are proponents here, at least listening and can speak back, would they be opposed to adding something like that that would insulate employers against liability?
Ms. Rodriguez, what is your understanding of, you know, the national conversation around that issue?
There have been, so Kansas is actually not a ban the box state, but there are some states that have considered negligent hiring provisions, and what they do is just make sure that they are very carefully tailored to the specific law and are not so much of a, end up being too widely interpreted for other employer behavior and undercutting worker protections. But it is something that has been considered.
Just to follow up, do you know of any states that have such policies written into their ban the box legislation?
I know that Minnesota did not have it as part of their ban the box legislation, but it was part of the discourse and is connected to it. As well, I believe New Jersey is another one of the states that has a negligent hiring provision.
Okay, thank you, and we can look into that. Any further questions? Yes, Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, all of you. And it seems to me a natural consequence of the problem that we've been hearing about, particularly from the individuals that have been affected by this, is that when you're asked this question, you just wouldn't answer it honestly because you would know that you're unlikely to even be considered. Do you have any idea how common it is for people to have to just not tell the truth and then run the risk that that information comes to light later and they get fired because they haven't been truthful?
I don't have that information.
I think that it does happen fairly frequently that people either don't check that box or give information that's other than the truth. And what often happens is that if it comes out later, they are in double jeopardy because they've, you know, either been employed or whatever, and then they're found that, you know, they didn't tell the full story on their application form, and they face termination, which is equally as distressing as not getting the job in the first place.
And just one more, my comment is this kind of reminds me of when Oregon took the step of prohibiting employers from using people's personal credit history, which was also an obstacle for a lot of people to getting hired. And we did do that, and other states have followed in our shoes. And it seems like that has, no, it's not a panacea. This isn't either, but it's definitely one step toward leveling the playing field for people that face a lot of obstacles. So,
yeah, and if I could just follow up on your earlier question about the people who put themselves in jeopardy with how they answer, I've seen that firsthand where employees have assumed that the box didn't apply to them, either, you know, because their record had been expunged or something else, and then after the fact, it was discovered that, yeah, they did have a record, and they got into a lot of trouble and had a lot of difficulty as a result. So it's not always 100% clear.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Any other questions for the panel? Yes,
well, and
Senator.
Questions about certificates of rehabilitation. Does anybody know about how those work? Is that something that have entered into any of the conversations that you've been involved with on the phone there?
Yes, Michelle.
Yes, thank you.
So the question is, what about certificates of rehabilitation as a potential policy reform as well?
Right.
Sure. It has been something that I think being talked about nationally as an additional policy reform. I wouldn't say that it replaces the benefits of Ban the Box, but it can be also a helpful complement. As well, expungement and sealing in the same breath are talked about for records to ensure that some records are sealed.
Well, I was also thinking it along the lines of perhaps it being helpful in relieving some employer liability or angst in that area as well.
True. That is one effort that has been looked at in a couple of states as well, the combination of a certificate of rehabilitation with some negligent hiring provision.
Thank you. Okay. Yes, thank you. And actually, your question kind of segues into the final point that I was going to make. I think we've exhausted our questions of the panel, but you know, Ban the Box, I think, is an important initiative, but it's just one initiative among many that we're going to have to be looking at. You know, one of the, you know, the original charges of this committee, as we discussed at the beginning of this session, was to work on making it easier for ex-offenders to reenter the workforce and to get the workforce development, the training that they need, and, you know, as well as access to productive jobs. And, you know, during the interim, we will continue to work on that issue. I think we'll probably have a work group. I know Vice Chair Thatcher has expressed interest in that. Senator Winters has. And, you know, there are a number of things that we're going to want to look at. On June 1st, we will be having an informational hearing on pre-apprenticeship programs in prison and their effectiveness in creating successful transitions out. So, again, this is one initiative among many that I think we will need to look at. So with that, I want to thank you both and thank everyone who came today. Ms. Rodriguez, we thank you very much for giving us your time.
Thank you.
And with that, I will close our public hearing on House Bill 3025, and we will work on assessing what needs to be done for a work session. Okay. With that, colleagues, we are adjourned for the day and for the week.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
And for the week.